Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. And here is CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. I heard your podcast with Dorothy Brown, who wrote a book called The Whiteness of Wealth. And she was actually arguing that the tax code has racial overtones because of things like the marriage deduction. Can you explain that?
Well, it's quite fascinating, and her book is fantastic. It's very readable, and so I encourage folks to check it out. But the first point of entry for Dorothy Brown in tackling this subject, and she's a law school professor, is that she was doing her parents' taxes, and her parents and she earned about the same amount of money, right? So let's say that they both earned $90,000 total. Dorothy herself earns 90, and her parents each made $45,000. Mm-hmm. And in the way that the tax code has evolved, it treats those two types of tax situations differently. Why? Because with a married couple that's filing jointly, you have certain deductions available, whereas with one person, you have others. Now, we may have heard about this as the marriage penalty. Like people say, oh, you know, it took a while for people to understand that, you know, married couples shouldn't get penalized for being married. But it's gone the other way, which is when you have a couple and the couple is comprised of two equal-ish earners, they are treated less favorably in the United States tax system because of deductions. And that was her first entree into this idea, like, wow, that's weird. What else is in the tax code that doesn't favor certain people? And she looked at it through the lens of race because she found out that 40% of couples who are black earners, women are contributing, and in the only 20% or so of white couples. So there was the first entree into, wow, there's a real difference between these two types of earners.
So in other words, whether it's due to race or not, more white couples have a non-working spouse than black couples.
That's exactly right. And as a result, that means that, you know, sort of the broadest way of thinking about equity in this country, which is, hey, we all earn a living, we are treated differently. And I do think that that is something that's quite fascinating. And it led me to really start to think in a different way as she guides you through this. You know, she says it's not just the IRS, but obviously there are other parts of the economic system that exists where whites and blacks seem to be treated differently. Of course, in the housing market, we've heard about redlining, that there were laws that basically prevented black homeownership from occurring. And even in the tax code itself, that we treat homeowners preferably to renters. And so it really does disadvantage black people who have been shut out of the housing market much more so than white people.
She also mentions that in her ideal world, salaries and capital gains would be taxed the same.
Right. And so, you know, what we've always heard this mantra from investors that say, oh, no. My gains that I make in stocks, in my house, whatever, that should be treated as something different because then I'll reinvest it. And that's why it should be treated differently. But of course, what we actually learn is that that's not the case at all. And what happens is that rich people who make money off their investments, and even middle class people, they do reinvest it no matter what, whether it's taxed with a capital gains rate of 23.8% as the top bracket or their top bracket themselves. And so really, why do we make a distinction between earned income from labor and income earned or gains earned through your investing or through the appreciation process? And this, of course, does actually favor wealthier people.
Yeah.
And of course, because we know that net worth of black versus white households is like a gap that is huge. White households' median household net worth is 10 times that of black households. Then that just exacerbates and creates more inequality.
When you think about it, if somebody makes, I don't know, $80,000 a year driving a long haul truck, right? and somebody made $80,000 in a year because they just happened to pick a a good stock. I mean, if you're talking about who put in the most sweat to earn the money, it's obviously the person who drives the truck. And yet
right.
that person is taxed usually more than the person who made the money on capital gains.
And if I may point out an even further distortion, that person who is making, say, $80,000 a year from dividends or interest or capital gains often inherited that asset from a wealthier parent, and that and was not taxed on that asset upon inheritance, and or that asset hasn't been taxed yet. So I think that there are certain aspects of the law that we think, oh, it's just equal, but this analysis is just so fascinating to me, you know, that you know, if you think about it, and she says that, look, we've seen systemic racism really does actually bear out in marriage and earning, in home buying, in education, in the labor market, environmental, meaning that like certain areas where there are black households are just not making as much money, that all of this has created a system that exacerbates some of the issues that are already endemic in society.
But if you change that rate, I mean, if you change those marginal income rates on capital gains to the marginal income rate on a paycheck, for the middle class and sort of upper middle class, you know, when they cash out a stock fund to buy a house, for example, that'd be painful. I mean, we're talking like close to 40% in some cases tax on
it. I mean, but you can do carve outs based on income. And she says that very clearly. You know, we have carve outs in the housing market, right? We say, okay, the first $500,000 of capital gains in your house, if you're married, filing jointly, is excludable. You could do something similar and you could say for middle class people, and middle class defined as however you want to define it, let's call it less than $100,000 of income, you could say, you know what? You don't have to pay that. So there are carve-outs that are available. I think what she's really trying to talk to is not so much like what happens for the middle-class families, that that so much of the action is happening at the top 5% of society, and that you can really address pretty easily through the tax code. You know what her number one favorite thing to talk about is? That we should just go back to having every single individual file a tax return, whether you're married or single, when people love that. And then also have much more information published and transparent about race and money. So the IRS should actually try to create a database where they're capturing this information.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Great to be with you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's talk with CBS correspondent Robert Berger in Jerusalem, where we hear that Benjamin Netanyahu may lose the job of prime minister after 12 years. What's the situation, Robert?
Looks like that's what's going to happen. The opposition to Netanyahu has until Wednesday at midnight local time to form this government. And all indications are from the people involved that there will be this government of change, as it's being called, or a national unity government that would end Netanyahu's 12-year grip on power.
So what does that mean in terms of some of the issues that are keeping the two sides apart in these negotiations for a separate Palestinian state? Netanyahu was a hardliner on building settlements, correct? Would this new government change that?
Not at all. I mean, here's what's happening. Basically, this is simply a government trying to oust Netanyahu after four inconclusive elections in 2 years, but it's made up of right-wing parties. Naftali Bennett, who's slated to be prime minister, is actually further right than Netanyahu. It's also made up of left-wing dovish parties and centrist parties. So they're mainly coming together to try and oust Netanyahu, and then the bigger issues that are very controversial, such as a Palestinian state, land for peace, and those kind of issues are basically really going to be on the back burner, where you'll have a status quo situation on those kind of issues, and they're going to try and tackle other things where there is a national consensus, such as the economy, recovering from COVID, stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and things like that.
On the Iran story, I saw a headline in the Times of Israel this morning It's quoting Netanyahu saying Israel will choose thwarting Iran nuke program even at expense of tensions with U.S. Does that mean, I'm just reading the headline which just popped up, so I haven't read the whole story, but does that mean they would take military action to stop that nuclear program if it goes too far?
Well, that's always been the option of last resort. Obviously, the Israelis don't want to do that because it would mean a regional war with someone much stronger than the war that we just saw with Hamas in Gaza. I mean, Iran is a regional superpower. They have ballistic missiles and all kinds of weapons that could do a lot of damage to Israel. We saw what the Hamas rockets did from Gaza, but these are big ballistic missiles that could hit Israeli cities. It might bring in Hezbollah from Lebanon. But for the Israelis, an Iranian nuclear bomb is really, they're just not going to allow that to happen. So if the negotiations with the West, between Iran and the West, don't reach some kind of result to have them stop enriching uranium, then there is always the danger of an Israeli preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. But again, that's an option of last resort.
Okay, so replacing Netanyahu is not going to suddenly turn the Israeli government into a pro-Palestinian policy. So that sounds pretty clear. On the other issue that is still unresolved after the latest conflict, the bombing of that building housing the Associated Press, there were some allegations that this is the Associated Press's own fault because they were in a building which they knew was being occupied by Hamas. There was even allegations that they had some kind of relationship with Hamas. Do you know anything about that?
The Israeli Army Chief of Staff was quoted as saying that they had a right to destroy the building because AP journalists were drinking coffee every morning in the cafeteria with Hamas military electronics experts without knowing maybe that they were actually Hamas. It was kind of a quip, which the defense minister has since played down. And AP itself saying that there wasn't even a cafeteria in the building to have coffee together. It is known that Hamas does use civilian areas for military purposes. And, the Israelis would argue that they would probably think that's one place that the Israelis would never hit because AP was there, Al Jazeera, other international media. But, it's not exactly a free country over there in Gaza. I think you could say that maybe people might be afraid to admit if such a thing actually happened, if it happened.
One more thing, going back to the Iran story and the fact that they're a regional superpower. Could Israel handle a fight like that, or would that somehow mean that we have to get involved?
Well, it'd probably be hard for America to stay out of that. Yes, I mean, the Israelis, they've had backup plans for a long time. The big problem for Israel is that Iran is so far away. I mean, when they were bombing Gaza, that's right in their backyard, right? I mean, Iran, you're talking 11,000 miles. You would have to refuel aircraft to get there, and they have better air defenses than they do in Gaza. So it's very difficult. But, the Israelis also have weapons that we probably don't know about, or we assume they might have, such as their own ballistic missiles. So I think they could handle it, but it would not without a lot of damage to Israeli populated areas like Tel Aviv and Haifa and other cities.
CBS correspondent Robert Berger in Jerusalem. Robert, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dave.
Families of those killed by police in Washington State came together over the weekend to remember their lost loved ones and to celebrate the change that they have been able to bring about. With that report, joining us now here is Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, so over the Memorial Day weekend, there were a few different events that had happened with a variety of the families who've lost their loved ones to police in all of the Puget Sound region. On Saturday, there was a group called the Athletic Justice Collective. They are people who fight against police brutality and are working to change the laws, but also work in the sports world. So you saw all of the families come together, the loved ones of Charlena Lyles, Jackie Saray and many others who have been killed by police all gathered outside of Lumen Field, where they were presented with a variety of gifts from the group, including jerseys from Bobby Wagner and some Mariners players and some of our Seattle Sounders. And it was a bit of a celebration for their accomplishments. For much of these families have worked over the last several years to bring change to the state, especially with I-940, getting signatures for that to get the ballot to voters. And it's something that the uncle of Jackie Sawyer, who died in 2016 in Tacoma Police's custody, her uncle spoke at this event on Saturday and says they were able to get I-940 to the voters even after the governor told them that they didn't think it was possible.
That dream is becoming a reality today. We had no platforms whatsoever. We had no media outlets. We had no resources, but we assembled. And when we come together as one, we are so strong, united. And that's how we went back to the governor in 2018 and said, sir, here's 365,000 signatures for Washington State. There's a requirement for 265, but there's an extra 100,000 for you.
Several of the state lawmakers who had helped to get bills passed in the last session were also in attendance at the Saturday event, including State Representative Jesse Johnson.
Throughout this process, you all as families lifted up every voice, even those voices we did not want to hear, the law enforcement. But you showed poise and grace and made sure that these policies were comprehensive. It made sense for our communities, but we did not lose the fabric of the bills, which was to demand accountability, which is retroactive, and justice, which is proactive, so that these tragedies do not happen again.
One of the others who were there is Elaine Simon. Her son, Jesse Saray, was killed in 2019 by an Auburn police officer who had already killed two other people during his time on the force. He became later the first person to ever be charged under I-940. And Jesse Saray was killed in 2019 by that officer who his mom says was required to de-escalate under I-940 but failed.
This was a young man having a mental health episode, and he should have been contacted in love. He should have been contacted in a place of humanity. And what happened was the humanity was removed from the equation, and he was brutally killed.
In that case, there's video that shows that Nelson was supposed to just go and do a kind of a welfare check. Jesse Saray was outside of a convenience store. He was in the middle of a mental health episode of some sort. He had a history of drug issues and had been homeless, but the officer shows up and decides to try to arrest him for disorderly conduct. What follows is a shooting that's witnessed by someone in a strip mall parking lot. And as the officer shoots first, he shoots Jesse Saray in the stomach. He then stops. He clears a jam in his gun, turns and looks at the witness, and after several seconds, I believe it's 7 seconds, then shoots Jesse again in the head. And that is the first person who became charged as an officer under I-940 in our state. Then, of course, last week we saw the three officers in Tacoma who were charged in the Manny Ellis death. So the families come out to celebrate that over the weekend.
And in that case, are these officers being charged?
In the Jesse Saray case, yes. Yeah. Officer Jeff Nelson was an Auburn police officer. It was just a little under a year ago that Dan Satterberg came out and announced charges against him, murder charges, and he became the first officer in our state to be charged. He hasn't gone to trial yet, but I believe there's still quite a bit of an investigation going on. But yes.
So, I mean, a pretty sad gathering, I guess, except for the legislative accomplishments. And was the consensus among surviving family members that this is on the right track now?
That it's definitely on the right track, and they've made some progress. You know, there's certainly frustration that it took so long. A lot of these people have been working for this for many, many years and are still working for this. One of the big things that was celebrated over the weekend was a legislative victory for these families is that the bills that passed in this last session will be retroactive. So, for instance, mm-hmm. when there was an investigation into the death of Charlie Niles that, you know, didn't amount to anything, that can be reopened now under the I-940 law because of a bill that passed in the last session. And these families are not done yet. That was the other thing that was kind of the big takeaway over the weekend is we've accomplished this much, which, again, was really very historic in the last legislative session. There was a dozen bills that passed on police accountability, more than I think anyone ever thought would. But there's still a couple of really big areas they want to get passed in the next session, which are the independent prosecutions and also something to address the issue of qualified immunity.
Yeah. I know you've been trying to track the morale of police officers during this whole reform effort, and there has been some pushback. But, I mean, these details that we're hearing on some of these killings are horrific, and we're hearing about them for the first time, and they don't seem to have been reflected in the police reports. Are there officers who themselves are, I mean, some officers must be appalled what has been done by some of these people who wear the badge.
And I think some are. And I think, you know, the best way you can gauge that, there are some officers who are just like any other group. You cannot generalize when you're talking about police officers. There are great, the majority of, I think, cops are great cops who are out there. There are others who are bad actors. There are others who work for agencies who try to be careful about how they release information because they got away with it for a really long time. There was not that transparency that now is being demanded. And so I think you're seeing a shift in the way that things are being used to be handled and will now in the future be handled as far as transparency for the families and what goes out to the public. And another big push that you see from all of these families and all the lawmakers is for us, for the media. Someone just said last week at Manny Ellis's event that do not take the government or the police agency's word when they put out a press release about what happened, because we've shown that's not the case. So there's certainly some frustration among law enforcement. There are really good cops who are out there that these kind of things go down. I think you don't hear a lot of them being exceptionally vocal these days.
Kyra Reeders, Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you very much.
You bet.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. Wilberforce University held a socially distanced graduation ceremony on Saturday, and it ended with a big surprise. WHIO-TV's Ronell Hunt has the story.
Graduation music following an untraditional year, and after semesters of struggle through the pandemic, a surprise from the Wilberforce University president.
Because you have shown that you are capable of doing work under difficult circumstances, because you represent the best of your generation, we wish to give you a fresh start. So therefore, the Wilberforce University Board of Trustees has authorized me to forgive any debt.
Some students dancing, others crying after hearing the news. Wilberforce cleared more than $375,000 of debt from the 2020 and 2021 graduating classes.
It was more so, wow, like, really? It was like that.
The Thompson twins were among the 166 students who will take the next step of their lives with a new sense of financial freedom.
That being clear was it was very heartwarming, because now we can actually, like, clear our minds and actually focus.
For Tyler, his focus is to now join the police academy. His sister Taylor wants to get her real estate license and start her own business.
It makes me want to do more, actually, now that I know I don't have to worry about it.
The school used various scholarships, including the United Negro College Fund Incorporated, Jack and Jill Incorporated, and other funding sources to cover the cause.
Your accounts have been cleared. And you don't owe Wilberforce anything.
A celebratory moment to cap off these degrees.
One thing I can say is just keep going, keep pushing and keep growing, you know? Like, the bumps may come in the road, but we get over those.
At Wilberforce University, Ronell Hunt, News Center 7.
Wow. Imagine how much innovation and dreaming will happen now that no money is owed. That's great.
And by the way, the alumni department will probably be contacting them in the years to come, just in case they want to make a donation.
100%.
Yep. Now from the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 right here on Cairo Radio, here's G. Scott. Who can forget Marshawn Lynch saying, "I'm just here so I don't get fined"? He didn't much like talking to the media, and now Naomi Osaka has done the same thing. Except I don't think Marshawn was claiming depression or anything. He just was soured on the whole process. Whereas Osaka is saying that this is a mental health issue for her, and so rather than go on with this, she took her fine and then just dropped out of the French Open. She's number two in the world. What do you think about this, G?
Well, before I talk about Naomi, let me just talk about Marshawn. One of the biggest reasons why Marshawn did not like to do those interviews is because he couldn't talk how he wanted to talk.
Yeah.
Marshawn wanted to be able to get on there and talk how he wants to talk. And it's a little harder to not be yourself when you want to have to say some of the things that you should say, and you should talk like this and you should talk like that, and then the whole world judges you. But let me get on to Naomi. In this case, this is a sad situation. Tennis just lost one of the biggest stars from one of its biggest events. Why? Because let's be real. This world is too ignorant, if you will, to understand the importance of mental health, right? And it's not a game. Let's not forget, in 2018, when she won the U.S. Open in 2018, the then president of the USTA, Katrina Adams, during the trophy presentation said, "Perhaps it's not the finish we were looking for." That's because Naomi had just beat Serena Williams. And Serena, during the trophy presentation, had to calm everybody down because Naomi had just won. So I'm just giving you guys just a little example, mm-hmm. but I'm going to make this relatable here in a second. One last point to make. The French Tennis Federation president, Gilles Moreton, he made a statement in French about Naomi Osaka's withdrawal. Then he repeated it in English. And then, you ready for the kicker? Then he left without taking questions. Huh. Irony right there, right? Yeah. So how can I make this relatable? There's a lot of people that are hearing this story, and it's like, okay, guys, these are world-class athletes. They have money. I don't understand these type of problems. So what? You know, their mental health. Blah, blah. No, let me make this simple. Most of us, you're right, we are not world-class athletes. And if there isn't enough grace and empathy towards taking care of your mental health for those that are world-class athletes, for the best in the world, if it lacks understanding in that situation, then what does that mean for the rest of us?
What exactly are we getting from these press conferences,
yeah,
too? I'm the
question.
Last person who wants to stop, you know, journalists and reporters from doing their job, but I don't hear this kind of criticism from politicians who don't ask questions or don't answer questions, right? Like, we are just beating this 23-year-old star up because she's saying, hey, like, this is not helping me. The questions are repetitive. Even Serena said it last night. Like, I'm upset. Somebody was like, why aren't you smiling? You just won. And she's like, I'm upset because I don't want to be here. You guys keep asking me the same dumb questions over and over again. And I would rather go home and go to bed right now. So I just don't understand why this is such a big deal, other than that the money in this situation, the U.S. Open, the French Open, require it for publicity.
Right.
Good for her for saying, at 23 years old, I would have never stood up for my mental health. I'm, you know, a decade older than her now, and I'm just starting. So good for her.
I know that when people hear about this topic or read about it, they say, well, I can't relate. You know, this person is a world-class athlete. They got a lot of money. They can handle all those things. And
mental health doesn't know money. Mental health, you know, that's just, oh, those excuses.
So my point is that if that's the case and there's lack of empathy and grace for that, then how about those that mom that has three kids, and all Memorial Day weekend they had to do everything for their children, and then they go to work today on Tuesday, and maybe they want to go to their boss and say, hey, you know what, boss, I had a really rough weekend. Can I take a few days off, right? We need to understand, if they can't have empathy and grace for world-class athletes, what is being done to the rest of us, the majority of folks who are not world-class athletes, who are not millionaires, who do not have a lot of money? And so I think that's the biggest point of this all, as we are starting to hopefully get better in really addressing mental health.
Yeah, and whoever runs the French Open, the organizing committee, sort of shot themselves in the foot. What is the meaning of an Open that doesn't include the second best player in the world, right? No. What does that even mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's something. And I hope, look, I think she did a great job. And Colleen, you made a great point. 23 years old and just said, you know what? I'm just going to bow out. I'm just going to get out.
I would have never done that. I would have kept saying yes until I ground myself into the ground because I didn't know how to stand up for myself at 23. So kudos to her. She's a role model for everyone right now.
You guys think there'll be changes because of this?
I would think so. If they start losing the best players because of a policy that does not provide us with any more information, because Colin's absolutely right about these news conferences.
I think because of this stance, we'll see, not just in tennis, we're going to see changes in the future in other sports too.
A King County judge is expected to rule by the end of the week on a legal challenge over Seattle's new jumpstart payroll tax. And here's Car Radio's Hannah Scott with the latest. Hannah.
Yeah, Dave, remember this was the tax that the city council passed last year that would basically tax businesses with at least $7 million in annual payroll, up to 2.4% on salaries and wages that are spent on Seattle employees who make at least $150,000 a year. It's meant to bring in about $200 million in the first year that is seen as critical to basically help the city with the losses that it suffered during the pandemic and then be able to expand its spending moving forward on critical things like homelessness and all of that. But the Seattle Chamber Metro Chamber of Commerce filed a lawsuit just several weeks after this was passed. The Chamber's Alicia Teal recently explained that they want to work with the city.
We want to work with the city on economic recovery and transportation and homelessness and generating tourism and supporting arts and culture and all of those things that we've been talking about. But the other reality is that when we're talking about something that is illegal, like a tax like this, we will bring a lawsuit on behalf of our members.
She said the bottom line for them is they believe the tax is illegal.
It's true that when there are, you know, serious conversations about policy and revenue, the employers of this community want to be at the table. We stand ready to collaborate with the city leaders on good policy, and we encourage them to take a different approach than the one that sort of resulted in this legal challenge. And going forward for us, we feel like it is time to collaborate on legal and practical solutions that result in a change of outcomes and invest in a long-term sustainable recovery plan for our city and our residents.
But Seattle City Council Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda disagrees that this is illegal and says there was collaboration.
Large and small businesses with community partners and laborers at the table to make sure that in our state that has the most regressive tax system in the country, that we were stepping up, especially in this moment of crisis, for those largest companies who've done well and sometimes done better during COVID, that they pay a small assessment towards helping to make sure folks have housing, equitable development, and investments in Green New Deal and a resilient economy.
And she says that this revenue would be critical for the city.
Okay, so this is different than the income tax.
Yes, the which income tax?
The city income tax.
Yes, that was already defeated in court. The city's income tax that was passed a few years ago. This is what was called the jumpstart tax. It's a payroll tax, and it's based on again how many. Yeah. Your annual payroll. And it's, you know, remember we had the head tax back in 2018 that was passed.
Right.
And then they reversed course and did undid that, basically repealed that themselves. This is a different kind of effort in that same general kind of space.
Right. Okay. Because it sounded like in the clip that part of this was supposed to be used to solve the homelessness problem. But at the same time, we have this city charter petition, which is, I assume, going to make the ballot, which would do the same thing, correct?
That is correct. Again, this the big argument here, one, is that this is an illegal tax. It's a graduated tax based on, and they call it a payroll excise tax. So that's going to be the legal issue that has to be determined in court. Oral arguments were there on Friday, so we'll get that decision by the end of this week. This is a very big deal, though, because just like the Seattle income tax was, it's considered kind of a test case, right?
Yeah.
There was a lot of talk in the legislative session about doing this type of very same thing at the state level. So if Seattle, you know, prevails here, that could have some big implications statewide.
All right. Car Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.